But we're going to start right here in the front with District Attorney Spencer Merriweather. He's here, and we have talked a lot about police and law enforcement and their role in all this. And as District Attorney, you have made prosecuting sexual assault cases a top priority. So how do you think the justice system is serving victims? And I have to ask, because I didn't get to this in the program, we ran out of time, is justice, is there justice for these people? Are they getting justice?
There is justice. It's hard fought. I think Sarah made the point that it takes fighters. We certainly hope that the survivor isn't the person who has to do all of the fighting by herself, but it does take fighters within the system to get that justice. But we do believe that justice can be served. Well, and a lot of you may be new to this. Well, at least the prosecution of sexual assault within the justice system. And what's important to know about it is the people that have dedicated their lives to doing this work, it's mission work. It's mission-based work. These people are champions. We all have been trying to work harder to try to train ourselves at getting better at this. There's three numbers that no one even mentioned today. It was Rule 412. Used to be you could ask every question under the sun about someone's sexual history. Now you can't do that. The system has gotten better because someone decided to stand up and actually fight for victims. It used to be we didn't ask questions about, or we asked questions and expected these linear stories, as Chief Grau actually talked about. And we know now that we can't expect that. We've had to get better about the way that we interact with survivors. What I also have to say is that while this is mission-based work, as you indicated, we're still doing this within the framework of a constitutional system, one that says that we have to figure out a balance between fighting hard for someone who's gone through something terribly traumatic and at the same time trying to preserve the rights of the accused. One of the things that never gets mentioned about sexual assault is that there is a right to confrontation, right to confront your accuser in our Constitution. And while that's a constitutional premise that we all accept and believe in, do you know how horrible that is for someone who's actually gone through a sexual assault to have to walk in a courtroom and actually face the person that did it to him? So if someone has tried these cases for 3 years, that's the first discussion I have with a survivor, is that this is part of the deal. And if a person is willing to go through and accept that idea and that notion, then you can go to that next step. But none of this is easy. We'd be lying if we said that just like that we can make this an easy process for a survivor, because we can't. This whole thing is a tragedy. We just have to make it a little easier for people, and there are people on this stage who are trying.
And what I'm hearing you say is you are making inroads into doing just that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Alex.
My name is also Alex.
Oh, okay. Well,
great name.
Fortuitous.
Yeah, great, awesome. I'm born and bred in Charlotte, and I just wanted to say that words are very powerful, and that one way that CMPD can actively show empathy for people that have been through this kind of trauma is to refer to them as survivors, not victims.
And we have somebody filled out a comment card before we started. Is Linda's story common with CMPD, or is it an aberration?
Well, I hope that it's not. I mean, it's certainly 281 times a year we have victims that report sexual assault, and I'm sure there's more than that that don't report. But my experience with our detectives is that this is a little unusual, and we don't have victims who feel like they weren't heard or treated in a compassionate way.
Does it take from 2015 to 2018? Will a rape that happens tonight,
like I said,
April 2021?
Prior to 2016, it wouldn't be uncommon for it to take 17, 18, 19, 20 months for a case, for a rape kit to work its way through the lab.
Okay.
Since 2016, that's not the case.
And the only way to speed that up is more money, more people?
More equipment, resources.
Okay.
Mike, I'd like to add to your original question, though. Is Linda's story unusual? a lot of the women that we see have never reported. For them, justice was trying to find a way out of that dark space that can control you, it can ruin you, or you can fake your way through it, but you're still lost in the dark of it. And so for us, justice is simply trying to find a place where it doesn't control you and you can move through it in a healthy and healing manner. But I tend to believe that, you know, 60% of survivors never report. That Linda's story, it's not as common, but I think that there's certainly room for more Lindas to be able to come forward and advocate because of her courage and conviction.
And Lieutenant, you've said that you don't believe the criminal justice system is serving sexual assault victims. You're reluctant to point fingers as to why, but society, you say, needs to shoulder some of the blame. Is that just getting back to victim blaming, or is there more to it than that?
No, that's it. I think I pretty much answered that question. I mean, our jury, which I think, Mr. Prosecutor, I think anything you do is geared towards convincing a jury of 12, all 12 of them, not just 11, all 12 of them. That's so ingrained that the victim blaming, again, I'm sorry, I'm a broken record, the victim blaming and the rape myths are so ingrained in everybody in this room and everybody in society, which is our jury pool, that it makes those cases complicated. We're not getting justice for victims.
The one thing that I would say in regards to that question about is Linda's story common, I think about what Linda said to me the first day that I met her, which was about the questioning that she felt like she was asked, mm-hmm. like, if you're lying, you could be arrested, something about false allegations. And if you listen to this week's podcast, we play a portion of a conversation she had with Detective Kogel, who worked her case. And Detective Kogel, when she's confronted by Linda asking, you know, this really hangs over my head of feeling like I wasn't believed from day one, Detective Kogel's response, which I believe was very sincere, but it was, well, that's what I say to everyone. And to me, that's the problem. That's if that's how you're starting, you know, and I can't speak for every detective at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. And I know that there are victims that and survivors that have gotten in touch with us that had good experiences with CMPD. But if that is how you're starting those really important conversations, Harold Medlock talked a lot about the R word, relationships, and how that's a complicated word for police sometimes. If you're starting a relationship off on that foot of not necessarily believing someone or making that person feel like they're not believed, that's a problem. And Detective Kogel's response to that in this podcast, I hope people will listen to, I mean, it made it sound like that was something she did very frequently.
Is that policy?
I think no, absolutely it's not policy. But I think in fairness, what Detective Kogel also said was, I work every case, you know, whether I believe the victim or not, I work every case based on the evidence that I have, and that it really didn't matter to the detective if she believed the victim or not. She was going to work really hard to try to determine what happened in the case. No, it's not our policy to tell victims that we don't believe them or tell them that they could be arrested if they don't tell us the truth. What we do want to tell victims is, like I described earlier, that they've experienced trauma and they may not tell us things in a linear way,
right.
And that it's really, really important that they be completely honest with us. I think sometimes we heard that for people, they want to blame themselves. Should I have, I shouldn't have, why did I do? And we want them to be able to tell us those things so that it makes the case more prosecutable. And so we want them to be honest. And I don't think it's uncommon for us to say, you can tell us whatever, you know, it doesn't matter whether you were using drugs or whatever. We want to know that so that we can help work through this case with you.
Okay. Over here.
Mike, good evening. My name is Kevin. I live here in Charlotte. It seems to me like, and as a man, we tend to be more solution-oriented, going right for the solution. This rape kick thing just keeps coming up and coming up, and I've been hearing about this for years. The questions that come to my mind are, is this a pharmaceutical company that's making these things, or is it a mom-and-pop company out in Dubuque, Iowa? Why isn't it being marketed? Why isn't every damn hospital have these things, just like they have gurneys on the floor? Why don't they have these rape kits in every single hospital?
You go into great detail in one of the episodes about exactly what is a rape kit, what's in it, mm-hmm. and how it is dealt with by the specially trained nurses who administer the examination using the rape kit. Talk about that.
Well, they are expensive, and part of that is
the why they're a cardboard box the size of a shoebox.
Right. Oh, sounds really familiar. I understand from my understanding from our reporting is that it's expensive to actually the testing, okay. having the technicians that are qualified to do the testing. I mean, you know, just anyone can't test it. I think the question is, I understand the your comment. I think the question is, what can we do to better help the police fix the backlog problem? Because it is a resource thing. So it is, you know, and this is something like as a reporter, I'm curious, like, who needs to write the check for the crime lab? Or you know, like, what do citizens that want to get involved, like, what is the solution there? I feel like that's something that I wish we would have been able to dive into more is how do we end the backlog? Do you have any insights to either one of you guys?
My understanding is being worked on now with our state legislature. I mean, I mentioned the previous inventory law that came out that required all law enforcement agencies to inventory their sexual assault kits. Now, my understanding is, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, they're actually working on getting funding to get both a tracking system
right.
for all rape kits and the funding to reduce our backlog and to reduce all future backlog.
But getting back to the audience member's question over here, I mean, are they? You described them in your podcast as being something the size of a shoebox, and in that shoebox are envelopes that are sealed, and that are, with explicit instructions on what you should do, and swabs, and how to use the swabs, and where to put them, and how to seal them, and so that they are then incontrovertibly evidence, mm-hmm. and not tampered with. It doesn't seem to be that the kit is expensive. It's the process of analyzing the kit that's expensive. So why would not every hospital have available at any given time 30 kits?
Right. I think that's a question for those hospitals, too. Okay. I mean, to be fair, I think that's a great question. I think it's a question for them. The kits, right, aren't the most expensive part of that. It's the time. And it's also having people that are qualified. I mean, you don't have to have a sane nurse. That's kind of like the golden standard, to have a sane nurse that's gone through that additional training to do the exam. But you can have an ER doctor. You can have other nurses they're detailed. Those instructions are detailed for a reason. And it's not for those sane nurses that have been through that additional training. It's right. for those people that don't do it every day and need to know from square one, what do they do? So I would say that question is a question for the hospitals and the healthcare system.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, this is Kelly from Charlotte. So we know that overall Department of Justice shows that crime is overall down in this country, but sexual violence remains high. There are about 500,000 women in Charlotte. One-fifth of them will be survivors of sexual assault. That's about 100,000. 30% will report it. That's about 30,000. I want to know how many rape detectives are currently with CMPD. Is it adequate? I know that's a difficult question to ask you. Why don't we have more lab technicians, dedicated DNA, machinery, and resources like we talked about? And if you don't, what can we do as taxpayers to make sure that you do? Because this is a crime that affects all of us.
So we have 6 sexual assault detectives that work in the sexual assault unit that receive active cases. And then we have 1 detective that works cold cases along with a supervisor and a couple of people that are part-time. So we also, as Lieutenant Summer and Dyke mentioned, have a cold case unit. Certainly there is a process that we're going through now as an organization. There is no standard in this country that says if you have an investigative services group, how many detectives you need for a particular crime. So it's a little different in patrol. We have a formula that can say this is about how many patrol officers you need to police a community our size. There is no standard in our country on the number of detectives that you need to investigate cases. And so as an organization, we are trying to develop that standard. And so currently, we have a records management system that we use to track our cases, and it basically says whether the case is open or whether the case is closed. But there's certainly statuses between that. So if a case is open, well, I may have made an arrest and I'm waiting on Mr. Merriweather to prosecute that case, and that case may not be actively worked because there's not a lot of active things I need to do, but when that case is coming to trial, there may be things that the district attorney's office asks us to do, and so we're working that case again with the cases that are being currently assigned. So we're trying to develop a national model that says this is how many detectives that you need to work sexual assault cases in a particular community or organization.
If you had enough detectives and you had enough money for the lab work to be done in an appropriate amount of time, given the state of DNA today and what we can do with DNA, would you solve more of these assaults?
Yeah. Heck yeah, man. I mean, yeah, just think about it. I mean, I think you had a great comment. I think the retired homicide detective who's a sheriff now, I think, mm-hmm. he hit it on the nail. He said, you know, for every 10 cases you have, you're helping out on 40 others. So that's 40 more reports you got to do. That's possibly 40 more times you got to testify in court. I mean, you're on vacation, you're on sick leave, you got a sick kid and all that. But, if you had, and we've recently experienced that. We've recently had the luxury of having PERF come in and kind of revitalize our unit and give us some good suggestions. So our chief at the time, he doubled the size of our unit. And I can immediately see instead of, you know, sifting through cases, and they have cases that are open for 5, 6, 8 months. Now we're trying to get them, you know, maybe within 3 months, not including lab work time, of course. So, yeah, I've seen a significant increase in the time we can actually spend on cases, which equals to, you know, we're going to put more bad guys in jail. Yeah.
But is DNA testing, is that the magic bullet, or is that just television?
No, because, you know, you're not going to get DNA on all of it. Sometimes it's just an old school rape case. You know, it's just, as you said, he said, she said, and you do your darndest to make it a he said, they said case, and, you know, get improve your chances of prosecution.
Okay.
I'm a sexual assault victim, and I was sexually assaulted in 2015 as well. Two of my questions are, I was never contacted by my detective, who only contacted me once after our initial meeting, about my rape kit even ever being analyzed. I don't even know if it still exists. And secondly, I did not even get help or really answers from the police department until I was able to have funds for a lawyer in 2018. And once we pulled the police reports and showed, you know, my words versus what was taken down, because the person who did the report can analyze and write things in their own words, they distorted my story based off of their own perception of how I was answering things, because they took it right after my rape kit was done in the hospital.
Was that here?
Yes.
What role does the officer's perception play in how the case proceeds?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes, you know, based on your personal experience, you may have an opinion, but what we train our officers is not to put your opinion in a report. You just the facts, ma'am. That you try to get that information so that then a detective can follow up on it. And if you're willing, there's someone in the audience here that works for CMPD that I would be glad to follow up with you and find out what happened with your case. It's our expectation as an organization, when a victim reports a violent crime, which sexual assault is, that we follow up with that victim within 24 hours. And so if that's not what happened, that's not our expectation. So I can certainly have somebody follow up with you today.
Hi, my name is Brene Forrest. I was also sexually assaulted in 2015, actually in June 2015. I would like to ask a question to the district attorney as well as the police officers. So long story short, like I said, I was sexually assaulted, and apparently there is a law that only in North Carolina you are legally allowed to rape somebody until their consent. What happens is the guy can insert into a vaginal area, and it's not considered rape until they take it out and put it back in. And I had to hear that from a victim's advocate, and then I had to explain that to a detective because they didn't know that law exists. So how do we, or how does North Carolina help eradicate that law?
First of all, is that true?
Yeah, are you talking about withdrawn consent, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah. please let me answer this. Yeah, so we're kind of dealing with this. We had a case like that in Fayetteville recently. What it stems from is an idiotic case law from the 1970s that's still on the books. So if you want to affect change on that, get with your local legislatures and let's get it off the books, for one. Two, I know we've already been in discussion with our police attorney on that. And, sir, correct me if I'm wrong. That there are, I think, as long as you have a scenario that's not the same as the case law scenario, you can try to proceed forward and get new case law created. So we're kind of in the works of trying to do that. But it all stems on our district attorney willing to go forward with that. So we're trying to identify a potential case to create new case law with regard to withdrawing consent, because it's ridiculous. It needs to end, and we'll try to get it done here. But all of you play a part in that, too. So thank you.
Spencer Merriweather, you want to comment
Lieutenant
on that?
Got it exactly right. The only thing I would add is that functionally, the case is called State v. Way. Functionally, if we all are doing our jobs correctly and we're asking the right questions, that case usually will not be applicable. Without getting into too many details, the withdrawn consent, if you are really getting a full capture of exactly what it is that happened, doesn't necessarily end up really applying that much. Still, if it applies once, it's once too many. Quite frankly, that's legislation that I support as well. I do know that it has been pending through the last couple of sessions of our legislature, and hope that it passes summarily.
Thanks. Okay, up in the back.
Hello, my name is Mark Fraser with Positive One, and I know the emphasis tonight is on sort of solving the crimes after these things happen, which is a reactive approach. At what point are we going to begin to be more proactive and start really coming up with trainings and investing our resources in preventing the perpetrators from committing the crime in the first place? Because the survivor still has to live with it, even knowing the perpetrator is in jail. So are there efforts, and you know, maybe Crystal, you could speak to this with all the work that you've done, and even the police officers, are there more efforts to invest resources in prevention and really wrap our arms around men who typically commit these crimes more often and really get them to stop these acts that they're committing?
Yeah, how about this? I'm going to throw it back on you, sir, and everybody in the audience. How about this for a novel concept? Why don't we teach the young men in our life, our sons, our cousins, our nephews, not to rape women, not to beat on women? Let's be role models for the young men in our lives from an early age. I mean, once they get to the point where they're raping women, it's too late. I mean, the prison system ain't going to cure them. Nothing's going to work. But every man in this audience has a young man in their life that I'm sure they're a role model for, whether it's somebody they're related to or not. Teach them how not to rape women. Teach them how not to beat on women. Teach them how to treat women right.
I also tend to think, and this is coming from the perspective of a survivor, until we and all of you amazing women that have stood up and said you're survivors, like, hell yeah, thank you for doing that, first of all. But until you get help, and until those of you who did not say that you're a survivor, until you get help and come to a point that you can start having conversations with your children, That's when it's going to end, is when we become empowered survivors and we educate our children, and then that cycle just grows. That's how I believe we're going to stop it, because I don't think any like billboard campaign or advertising campaign, none of that's going to get to the heart of it more than a survivor telling their child the good and the bad touches and how to treat people. So I think it starts again in this room and all of you amazing people taking a step to become advocates for yourself and for each other.
My name is Sue Ann Wren, and I would like for Crystal to share some of the services that are available for brave ones who come to Brave Step.
Thank you, Sue Ann. So we provide individual counseling, all led by a very vetted group of trauma therapists who are very trained in trauma, group therapy, empowerment programs, peer support groups. Basically, we want to customize it to each individual, because every single story, albeit there are commonalities, every single person is unique and they need to be treated that way.
I want to follow up on something. Yeah, I think, Deputy, you mentioned that the amount of time to process rape kits in Mecklenburg County has gone down, and CMPD is investigating what went wrong or what could have been done better in Linda's specific case, are there any other specific changes that will come out of what you learned from listening to this podcast and talking to Sarah and how it was reported over the last several months?
Well, and I think the other kind of thing that came out of it, just talking to Linda, just an opportunity to hear from someone who had experienced this personally and to be able to go back to our unit and develop additional training to have further conversations to say, this is the way the words that you said were perceived by the victim or the survivor that experienced a sexual assault. You know, just to make us better. I think as an organization, that's what we do, and that's what we should continue to do.
Because Lee in the audience said, what is CMPD doing to instill new programs to aid victims of traumatic crimes, as well as how to educate officers to treat them appropriately?
So we have ongoing training. The training that I talked about where you learned about how a brain processes trauma is something that I experienced again recently, and it's ongoing. It's not something that we can train our officers in the academy and kind of check a box and be done. It has to be ongoing. I shared with some others that, and I think Crystal and I were talking about it earlier, about the secondary trauma that our police officers experience. And that's also a concern for us because then they may convey or transfer some of that trauma to victims. And so at CMPD, we have a police psychologist that our employees can talk to. And so recently we started in our crime against children unit and our cyber crimes unit that investigate child pornography. And so we asked those officers voluntarily to meet with our police psychologist to have a conversation about how the cases that they investigate and the things that they see as a part of their job affect them personally. And last week we moved that conversation to our homicide detectives and our sexual assault detectives, because we know that our officers who hear this type of information daily, it impacts them as well. And we want them to be well, to have great mental health so they can provide great service to our community.
And Crystal, I don't know whether you said this in the podcast or whether you said it the last time you were on our program, but the survivors of sexual assault, they suffer PTSD. Mm-hmm. And there are many ways people deal with that, but it really never goes away, right?
No. I think that especially with good trauma care, you have to go in it. You have to go and face it. But a good trauma therapist can help you get through it so you can learn coping skills to minimize the effect and the control it has. But, I mean, I was 10 years in therapy and will never, ever forget the experience that happened to me. And I think that applies to many of the survivors. They can get to a good place with it, but it doesn't go away.
Okay. Where are we next? Over here?
Hi, my name is Lorelei Kitchick, and I just wanted to thank the lieutenant for sharing the idea of training. It was obvious I said to my daughter, he's been trained. My questions are, who funded the training? How often do you get the training? Do you share the training with schools? Do you take the training, in other words, to third graders? Because as you said, we're the jury pool, and the children we need to educate them. Where did you get the money from?
Yeah.
Is my real question, because everybody wants to fix a problem, but we need funds to do that, grants, whatever.
Yeah, thank you. The biggest training we've had has come from our Sexual Assault Kit Initiative grant. We got some money to do some department-wide training, just basically I'll give them a shameless plug, a company called Blue Line Training Group created a four-hour training, a basic sexual assault response investigation training for all of our swarm patrol officers to attend. So that helped out quite a bit. We are extremely, extremely lucky to have somebody, the head SANE nurse at Womack Army Hospital. She's like a national expert in the neurobiology of trauma. She actually trains for free our police academy and some of our other, like our domestic violence liaison officer program and sexual violence liaison officer program. As far as getting into schools, so yeah, that's a unique challenge with that. I don't know as far as going in talking about sexual assaults, if that's what you're talking about. That's something that hasn't been broached yet. I know we do have like the bullying programs, the sexting programs and things of that nature that we get into schools with, but to go in there to talk specifically about sexual assaults at that young age, We haven't done that. We've went to some of the colleges, you know, the local colleges, and of course the Young Army guys on Fort Bragg and had conversations with them. But yeah, thank you. That's a good comment. Thank you.
At CMPD, it's similar to in Fayetteville. There are great resources in our community. Safe Alliance is an organization in Charlotte that has advocates that come to the CMPD and help us do training. We've developed a sexual assault response team that involves advocates, law enforcement, the district attorney's office, medical professionals that we partner with them. They do training for us, not only for our detectives, but for our patrol officers to help officers in the field who encounter victims of trauma to know kind of what kind of questions to ask and how to work through that.
I know we've talked a lot about costs. We've talked about costs to the state, costs to the police departments, costs to the hospitals, but what about costs to the victims? If a young lady, young man, or any age walks into a hospital right now and says, I've been raped, and they say, they want to have a rape kit run, are they going to incur any personal costs from the hospital at all? Is that something that we need to address? Is that something that people need to realize that they can walk in? Are they going to receive a bill, or are they going to be able to walk in and not have to worry about that cost?
Yeah, that's a really good question. My understanding, and feel free anyone else to jump in, but the kit itself and the exam is something that you wouldn't be paying for. But if you had something like a broken bone from your assault, that's not necessarily something that's going to be covered. My understanding is that there's specific aid that you could apply for, but whether you actually get it or not, that's that's what it is. But the exam and getting the kit done, I believe that's supposed to be free.
That's true. My understanding, I believe there's actually a state law that covers that. There's money from the state that covers that.
A victim compensation fund.
Is that once the case is prosecuted and settled, or is that immediate?
It's a good question.
Okay.
What's the answer?
It's taken 3 years
that's
for Liz.
All of them. Yeah.
Over here.
You know the answer. Okay. It takes time because you have to do your after you do the kit and you have to actually meet with a detective, that way they can start running a report and type up your notes, and then your notes are sent to like victims compensation. They have to approve what actually happened and notate that you were a victim, and then they send everything to the hospital.
Okay.
So that's how
Thank you. I'm being told we have time for one more question. Go ahead.
Several months ago, my name is Margaret. I live here in Charlotte. Rick De La Canal mentioned the Stanford study on rape. And I went back and found that online. And I think everyone who can handle, this is from the Journal of Forensic Science, March of this year. It's an amazing study. And there's lots in there. You can read the summary, even if you can't handle all the statistics in the middle of it. But one of the statistics that's pretty overwhelming, and I asked a lot of my women friends, okay, so these guys studied rapists. They went and visited them in the prisons and interviewed them extensively. They four major cities in the United States. They asked, well, how many rapes did you commit after? Well, what do you think the average number was? My friend said 5, 10, 26. That's an average.
Do you have a question for the panel?
I think I'm just asking people to go back and read the study because there's a lot of other things in there that are important and relevant to North Carolina, to the Attorney General's attempts to get money to get all the kits tested. So go back and read the Journal of Forensic Science.
I read that figure this afternoon. I didn't know it came from Stanford, but I read the 26 number. And are you familiar with that, either of you?
It's disturbing. It's alarming. I think one of the best things that helps us identify those cases when there's multiple cases is DNA. So when victims get a sexual assault kit done and the DNA is then entered into the national database, CODIS, it allows us to put those cases together and prosecute that person for the additional cases.
I want to thank Katrina Grau from CMPD for being with us tonight, along with John Summerendike, who came all the way up here from Fayetteville and has to drive all the way back tonight. Thank you so much for that. Crystal Emmerich from Brave Step. And I want to do a shout-out. This is unusual that I would do this because it's like tooting our own horn. But your work on this podcast has been, and your colleagues' work on this podcast has been remarkable. And I think, as what Joe said at the very beginning, the number of people who have downloaded this and the international exposure that it's getting tells me that you're telling a story that no one has ever heard before. And that is remarkable work. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you guys for being here. And thank you for listening. I really appreciate it.